This is what we'll all be doing before we talk. This is such an honor. Thank you so much for having me here. And
see if it unblanks it. No. Oh. One second.
There we are.
Thank you. And in the future, we'll all be members of the AV squad. Classification puts like next to like. We get to choose exactly what we want to count as like, what the principle of likeness is. But it works because the world has attributes that are clustered. Those attributes just seem to come together. So if something looks and smells and feels like a strawberry, it's a very good chance that you're not going to be picking pieces of wax fruit from between your teeth, although sometimes you do when you bite into it. It's probably the taste attribute is probably going to come along with it. And that's the only reason that we can do any type of classification, much less taxonomizing. So Plato, of course, talks about this in terms of carving nature, that the wise person knows where to carve nature, where to butcher nature, to find the joints, which implies, of course, and I just like the cannibalistic bull there, which implies that nature has these joints, that there's something in nature you can go right or wrong with them. Well, Umberto Eco, who the name of the Rose author, who turns out to be a actually pretty good and very hard academic philosopher, of whom I understand only a little, says, well, you know, it seems like things have a grain. It's not that you can divide them up any way you want, but there are lots and lots and lots of ways to divide it. It's as if you can cut with the grain. And I'm not sure, that's a little bit helpful. I'm not sure that that's totally right. It may be that you have to divide nature at the joints only if your knife isn't sharp enough. It is right, though, and this is what he says, that, you know, Eco says that you can carve it up many ways, but you don't get pieces of meat where the nose, the snout's attached to the tail. It just, you know, it doesn't work that way. And so we come to the planets, which had been, of course, I mean, this is the prototype of a natural order, of natural joints. There are 9 planets. We even have a mnemonic for them. Our school kids learn these. This is as natural as a joint gets. And then, of course, this summer, the International Astronomical Union went through a very embarrassing public fit as it tried to figure out what makes something a planet, because other objects planet size have been discovered circling our sun. So what makes a planet? And they did this in public. They had a committee that met for years, and they threw out the results of the committee, and they put together another committee, and they put it to a vote and a series of votes, and they finally decided that what makes something a planet are 2 principles. The first is that the object is large enough, that it has enough mass, that it rounds itself, that gravity rounds it. And the second is that it's large enough that it clears the space around it. And if you apply those 2 principles, you get 8. Say goodbye to Pluto. You get 8 of our planets back. You don't get 9, but you also don't get 20. You also don't get a billion, which is possible if you consider everything going around the sun. So why those 2 principles? Because now we have principles, we've got our planets back, very good. Why those 2? Well, they were wondering how you come up with a size. So there are various proposals to do something arbitrary, the size of Mercury is the size of a planet. And then one of them proposed that, well, no, let's use physics. Physics says when an object gets big enough, it rounds, let's use that. But why use that as a principle? And clearing its space, Earth, by the way, does not clear the space around it, but we need to count the Earth as a planet, so we'll put that principle in abeyance. Why those 2? And it's very, very clear. We wanted the planets. That's why we found those 2 and not 2 others or 3 others or 1 other principle. Right? So in fact, a year before this came to a vote at the convention, at the conference, the New York Times editorialized about it. The planet Zena had been discovered, and the Times said, we don't want 20 planets. We don't want 30 or 100 planets, they said. Why not? Well, the basic argument was, won't somebody please think about the children? It was the essence of the art. The kids know those 9. They're not going to memorize 20. Can't we please just have the 9 back? And the IAU said, okay, we will do that for you. And so they did. It's very obvious that if If the astronomers are carving up the universe at the joints, it's not science that's guiding their knife. Something else is. Nothing wrong with that, but we should recognize it's not science. And one of the good things about this public humiliation, was that it makes it ever more clear. It's one in a series of clarifications for the public, for all of us, that knowledge isn't quite what we thought it was, that the joints of nature aren't nearly as secure as we thought they were, that in fact it has a lot to do with the principles by which we choose to cut and how sharp our knives are. So I want to talk briefly about seven properties of knowledge. And since I say briefly, I should let you know that there's a point in this where I'm pretty sure you're going to think I'm done, and I'm not. And I'll let you know, just so you won't be too disappointed when I continue. I believe I'm going to use the word so in a way that will convince you I'm done. But so, not this. What wasn't it? So I want to talk about seven properties of knowledge briefly. These are traditional notions of Western knowledge. I'm only talking throughout this whole thing. I'm only talking about Western notions because that's all I know anything about. So seven properties of knowledge. The first is that it's a three-termed relationship. And all of these should be totally obvious, right? So it's a three-termed relationship. There's a knower, there's a known, and there's knowledge. That's Aristotle over there. Aristotle, of course, thought that knowledge was the thing in between mind and world that enabled the two to know one another, to be together. We, over the course of time, have managed, thanks to the help of highly neurotic philosophers, convinced ourselves that, in fact, knowledge is a representation of the world in our heads, and we live in our heads, and all that we know of the world is some reflection inside our heads, which is exactly what psychotic people believe. But the second principle is that we don't even have a plural for knowledge, there's only one. And third is that it's the same for everyone. There's one, it's the same for everyone. It's like reality in that regard. And it's binary. I know the electronic world is supposed to be the binary one, but it's in fact the real world that's binary, so that if two people disagree about something, some piece of knowledge, at most one can be right. If the world looks to me as it does on the left, but to you like it does on the right, at least one of us is wrong. It's probably you, and you're probably on drugs. There's only one possible truth about the world, highly binary. Next property of knowledge is it gets abstracted from the individual. It doesn't matter who says something that's true or what language he says it in or whether the voice is high or low. It doesn't matter. Person and knowledge get split, radically split. So it doesn't matter who says it. It's true anyway. Next property is that knowledge is simple, not in the sense that string theory, that's simple, but in the sense that it's simpler than the thing that it explains. The world looks chaotic and confusing, and over the course of time, as individuals and as a culture, we figure it out and we see the simpler principles underneath the seeming buzzing, blooming confusion that we experience. So it's simple in that sense. But knowledge, in fact, was invented in order to differentiate opinions we should believe and ones that we shouldn't, and most of the opinions we shouldn't believe. And knowledge is a relatively rare commodity. We need help, especially once there's so much of it to consider, from experts to help us decide what goes in the knowledge basket and what things don't. Knowledge is bigger than we are. This is Francis Mixa at the University of Texas, who put it this way, and his idea is that knowledge is this transgenerational realm. It's maintained by curators and filterers and maintainers who keep this realm orderly and who decide what gets in and out of it. And if you work really hard throughout your life, maybe you'll publish a book or two that will be accepted, and some ideas maybe that will be accepted into this transgenerational realm, and we'll all advance because of it. And that's sort of the image behind the notion of knowledge. And finally, knowledge is orderly. Obviously, it's not just a collection of facts. I mean, there's some order. In fact, that's the higher knowledge, is to be able to see what the order is. And it was Aristotle who told us, who for the first time pointed out, and actually had the conceptual framework to make this sort of thinking possible, that we, in fact, think by nesting hierarchically. And for Aristotle, what something is, to be a bird, to be a bird is to be like other birds, and thus have something in common, but also to be distinct from the other birds in the category. And the system of similarity and difference is so powerful that it allows you to explain complex systems, systems as complex as everything, as the universe. In part, this works because if you see the robin, You don't have to then say, oh, it's a bird, therefore it's a vertebrate, it's an animal, it's a living thing, it's made out of matter, string theory applies to it. You don't have to think any of that, but that's available to you if for some reason you do need to walk back up the tree. It is an incredibly powerful way of organizing the world, which is why we've stuck with it. But the notion is that there is a single taxonomy, a single way of ordering. Everything has its place, has one place, has a place and only one place in it. The principle of order here is very clear. It's a definition. It's a principle, a definition that decides which things get into the category and which things don't, and thus determines what things are. These aren't simply definitions. We're talking about what makes something into what it is. To be a robin is to be a feathered biped. To be a feathered biped or a bird is to be, and you walk back up. So it's not an accident that so many of those seven properties are in fact properties of the real world as well. And in part that's because we've conceived of nature, of knowledge as being a mirror of nature. But these are formal properties. I think it has to do a little bit more indirectly with the fact that we have in our tradition, we've used physical objects as the way that we preserve and communicate knowledge. And so knowledge is what fits into these physical objects. In later years, paper and books. And books have, as you know, peculiar properties. They're between covers. They take topics and they divide them into what fits between covers. They're two-dimensional in their surfaces. They are, although they can contain references, they are a terrible way to link knowledge. Books are self-contained. If you're in the Widener Library at Harvard, which is one of the world's great libraries, of course, and you come across a footnote and it's interesting and you want to track down the book, you know the rest of your afternoon is gone. You're going to be crawling over and climbing up and taking the elevator and taking the bridge and going down and going through a tunnel to get to the shelf only to find out the book's not there. It's as if books were designed to keep information apart. They're just not good at it, and they're not good at it because they're physical objects. You can see the role of paper at the headquarters of the Linnaean Society in London. You go into the basement, which is bomb-proof. It's a shelter. It houses the type specimens, which is one reason why it's bomb-proof. These are the original animals and creatures that Linnaeus and others classified, and you need those are the reference points, the anchors of knowledge, so they need to be preserved. But you go down, and there are some of the specimens, and there's the first edition of the Systema Naturae, his book that in two-page spreads, animal, vegetables, minerals, takes each of those kingdoms and maps them into boxes, nested hierarchical boxes. It's a map of all of creation. And it has to be oversized because there's a lot of nature to fit into two-page spreads. There's a lot of creation to deal with, but he does it. In fact, he called them kingdoms because he was thinking about this explicitly as a map. He was hoping that somebody would do an actual map of creation using his categories as political divisions. In one of the drawers, there are some of the index cards that he used, one per species. Writes down one per species. And if you record species, one per card, per paper card, of course you're going to end up with a map. Of course you're going to end up with a geography. Because you're going to take them, and you're going to lay them out on another two-dimensional surface, probably on your floor, because it's all of creation, for God's sake. So you lay them out on the floor, and you're going to cluster them and say, these go here, no, that one here, no, this one here, no, that one here. And of course you're going to end up with a top-down view, a two-dimensional top-down view of nature. That's how it works with paper. You can see the same thing with Mendeleev, who played chemical solitaire. He played patience. That's what he called it. He put all of the elements on each one per card, and then he laid them out. So of course he came up with a two-dimensional grid. Of course he did. One of the interesting things about that grid, in a more modern formulation, just for clarity, is that putting something in there actually adds information to it. So if you take any element and you see where it is and it's been put into its spot because of its ordinal, you know, it's a sequential number in the sequence, nevertheless, that spot tells you more. The row, the column, the grouping all gives you information about that element, which is why we think of the periodic table as a real taxonomy, whereas how you arrange your curry powder and your spice drawer doesn't tell you anything more about those things. And by the way, exactly the same as holds for the spice drawer holds for the planets. Knowing that something is a planet tells you two things, that it's big enough to round itself and that it clears the space around it and nothing else. There's no further information about it. The fact that something is put into a taxonomy that, and the taxonomy reveals stuff about it, is in fact the criterion by which we decide that a taxonomy is not just a matter of preference but has something to do with the real. But of course, nobody complains, nor should they, when other scientists come up with other ways of arranging these elements. There are many, many of them that reveal different relationships. There's an Earth Sciences periodic table that was done a few years ago, which has four spots for sulfur, because sulfur is found in four ionic forms on the Earth. That's fine. In fact, it turns out that Mendeleev's way of organizing was based upon a faulty principle. He didn't know about atomic number, because he didn't actually even believe in atoms. They didn't understand the structure of atoms well enough to be able to use it to taxonomize. Atomic weight is pretty good, but it's approximate. Atomic number, the number of proteins, protons is in fact the real measure, and explains, is the explanatory principle behind the properties, the attributes that get clustered successfully in the periodic table. So Mendeleev was able to construct this in a way that reveals true relationships, even though his own principle was faulty. So I'm certainly not saying that paper is determinative. I'm only saying that it tends to support certain ways of knowledge, certain characteristics of knowledge over others. That because you have to write things down once, it tends to be a single principle. You can only do it one way. It's the same for all. It's top down because it's a 2D view. It has to be created by experts because of the economics of publishing. It's expensive. Not everybody gets to publish. And it tends towards neatness, because in a two-dimensional view, if you have lots of lines and exceptions, you can't read it. But now we're digitizing everything. And I think it's useful to think of this, of there being three orders of order. In the first, we organize the things themselves. So this is the Bettman Archive, which is the nation's most important collection of historic photographs. It was purchased by Bill Gates in order to bury it 220 feet below ground in the middle of Pennsylvania, because it was melting, literally melting, in Manhattan. The negatives were falling apart. So now they're preserved in limestone quarries and in long, long rows of filing cabinets, where you get to take a photograph and put it into only one filing cabinet, because that's the way atoms work. In the second order of order, you go through the airlock. There's an airlock because they're lowering the temperature in the back cavern to below -4 below Fahrenheit. So you come through, and now you're in the second order, where you physically separate the metadata from the objects, and you get to do what's probably familiar to some of you, a card catalog, where you at least get to sort on three different orders, maybe four or five, but usually not much more than that. Of course, there's a price to pay. You have to reduce the amount of information to what fits onto a 3x5 card or so. On the other hand, it's much easier to walk through one of these than to walk through the 530 miles of books in the Library of Congress. So there's, obviously these are good things to do. But in the third order, everything's digital. The contents are digital, the metadata is digital, so you get to do stuff that you can't do, that's too hard in the real world. So I want to point to four principles that change. The first is that in the first two orders, everything has a place. It has a place. It goes on one branch of the tree. And as soon as things move online, we start filing them as many places as we can. So if you have a physical store and you have a new camera comes in, you're going to put it onto one shelf, because that's how atoms work. Probably the photography shelf. If you have a digital store and you get new information about the new offer for a camera, you'll put into as many categories as you can. Why wouldn't you? It helps people to find it. You sell more, your customers are happier. This is obviously what Amazon does. It makes up as many categories as it can and puts them all in a jumble on a page in front of you, because they want you to find books. Second is that in the real world, messiness is terrible. It's inefficient. It's entropy. Can't do what you want. In the third order, the more links you have going into and out of your site, the better, the bigger a success you are. You can have as many as you want. And since we have tools to help people find things in messy collections, it's not a problem. In the first two orders, there's a clear distinction between data and metadata. In the third order, if you're looking for that book, you know, didn't this guy Herman Melville write a book? What was the name of that? I think it was about a fish or something. You press search, and it comes back now with the content. Whether this is the Gutenberg project or the Google project or the other projects that have been started, it comes back with the entire content, which means you can now, as the data, right? So now, but now you can take, therefore, some of the content, say the first line, and use that as metadata. Say, what was the book that had that line in it, Call Me Ishmael? Who wrote it? Oh yeah, Herman Melville. And so what was metadata now becomes data. And the only difference between the two turns out to be that the metadata is the thing that you know, and the data is the thing that you're looking for. And the reason this is important, I mean, there's no distinction between the two. There's no formal distinction, only an operational one. And this is important because we use metadata, we care about metadata, because it lets us find stuff. So now if everything is metadata, our ability to find stuff has grown exponentially. Everything can help us find something else. Everything is metadata. And the fourth principle that changes is that if you go into, what's a local, I'm from the north, what's a local clothing store? Okay, I couldn't hear that. But if you go into that store and you take a shopping cart and you do the rational thing, the rational thing is that you go through and you pull off everything that's in your size. Just go right, just do that. And you make a pile in the shopping cart because everything else is noise. Everything else is a distraction. That's all you care. And you do that, you will be thrown out within 90 seconds. Soon as they figure out what you're doing, they're going to throw you out and they won't let you back in. Because the people who own the information have also owned the organization of that information. But if this were an online store and you didn't let your users search only within the stuff that fits them, they'll leave instantly. They won't give you 90 seconds. They won't give you 10 seconds. They'll just go. Of course you're going to do that. Because now, in the fourth order, the people who own the information no longer own the organization of it. The users get to own it. So I'm going to give you some examples. At least some of these, I'm confident, will be familiar. For example, there's this library. Yeah. That has a library that uses faceted classification, by which, as again I'm sure most of you know, if not all of you, enables a user to browse a tree, a taxonomic tree, but according to the order in which she finds it useful, not the order in which the creators of it have decided it will be stemmed and branched. So you start on any branch, go to any other branch, go to any other branch, and like a squirrel jumping from one branch to another, you're always confident you're going to land on another branch, as opposed to having to walk down the pathways that have been computed for you and decided for you ahead of time. And the experts who are deciding are experts, but as we know, there is no one way of navigating the world, the world of ideas and information anyway, or the real world, that suits everybody. This is delicious. Just to make sure, how many of you are familiar with Delicious? Okay, so it's a bookmarking site. You come across a page, you put it there, a link to it, and then you get to enter some tags, right? A tag to describe what the page is so you can find it again. And just for the two people who don't know what the tags are, along the right here, you see this person's tags. This happens to be the person Katrina. Everybody can get a free page at Delicious. More interesting than that, though, I think, is the fact that, I mean, that's a useful bookmarking tool, but Delicious is social, so everybody can see everybody else's tags. And, in fact, you can subscribe to a tag, in this case to robotics, and every day see all the pages anyone at Delicious has found and tagged with the word robotics, which is like having the world do your research for you. It's a very useful thing. Well, one of the things that's, I think, important about tagging, obviously, is let's say, so Flickr is another photo sharing site. It also uses tags, so I'm going to use a photo example. Let's say you have a photo of Aunt Sally on the beach in Cancun with the twins, Stanley and Manly, and it's her 70th birthday, and it's 2005. So using the foldering system that we have on our desktops, we could make folders that capture each of those salient facts. We could, and then we could make copies or links to that photo and file it in each of those folders. But we don't. Nobody does. We have disks full of DSC 001005. We don't even rename them, much less do that. So this is a failed strategy for everybody, I think, except for the most meticulous and obsessive. This is Flickr. You post it there. Instead of having to create all those copies, all you do is enter the tags. And so now we get multifaceted classification. Well, everything we do, especially if you were doing this in public, as at Flickr or Delicious, everything we do that's informational is also social, because we're social. You know, we just are. So as people create, this is these are the tags at Delicious, the pages at Delicious that have been tagged Cancun. You can see who tagged them. And so as you add your tagged pages here, perhaps, or search for Cancun, or robotics or whatever, you can get to know the people who have been tagging stuff. So you, every day, you may find that somebody else, some person you start to recognize has put in a tag. And maybe you discover that River Girl, I'll make it up, River Girl keeps tagging this really, really interesting pages she's finding. It's a different type of expertise than we're used to, but boy, she's really good at it. So you click on her name, and you see everything else that she's tagged, not just Cancun, not just robotics. You see the tag cloud, the list of things that she's tagged, gives you a pretty good instant representation of what she's interested in. It's a lot better than the profiles she filled out at Friendster, where, you know, what are you interested in? I'm interested in five things. That's, look at her list of tags at Delicious, and you get a much better sense of the hundreds of things she's actually interested in, because we don't know what we're interested in. Interest is not, they're not things we have, they're ways the world calls to us, and who can predict that? So this informational system instantly becomes a social system, because it's ours. That's what we do. So, that's the false so. Okay, I'm not done. So it seems to me that we are moving from a notion that knowledge, the best representation and structuring and way knowledge is to put it into a tree that's been carefully constructed by experts in the field who prune all of the stuff we don't need to know about, all the junk, who has time? So they filter what we need to know, they figure out the categories, they populate it. Same tree for all of us, because there's only one nature. I think we're moving from that to thinking, you know what's a better idea? Pull all the leaves off the tree and make this huge miscellaneous pile. But it's a pile of things that are connected, or that are linked in various ways. That approach flips the two basic principles that we've been following. So if you have this type of pile, it turns out it's much better just to include everything, not to exclude. Why exclude? It's actually harder and more expensive to delete things than it is to include them, which is why we have hard drives filled up with DSC 001, 001, 005. We don't have time even to go through them and delete them. It's easier just to keep it there, not to make the decision. Storage is getting close to being zero cost. It's so cheap. The curve is... So why not keep it? If you get rid of it, you may well be making the right decision for now for the class of users that you anticipate and the needs that you're anticipating, but you know, you're not God, so you don't know who's going to want it or what they're going to want to do with it. So you exclude the stuff about Paris Hilton because it's junk, you're right, but you also are guaranteed, and you know that within a year, 5 years, 50 years, there's going to be a graduate student doing work on the sociology of Paris Hilton who's not going to find any of that stuff. And furthermore, to take a really bad example, a distasteful example, the 1960 Sears catalog from which Lee Harvey Oswald ordered his rifle, that rifle was not tagged JFK. That would not have made it into the pile by any rational means, you know, any rational filtering. We don't know what's going to be interesting, what's going to be important. So include it all, especially since we now are developing the tools by which users can postpone the moment in which that stuff gets sorted and ordered. Rather than sorting and ordering beforehand, an expensive process that puts things into a single order that will suit many but not all, we can now allow users to sort and order and arrange and taxonomize and categorize and link the instant that they want it, the way that they want it. So I want to talk about three, see, I sounded like I was done, but I have three topics I want to talk about. The first is authority. So you are correct, I believe, we are correct in going to, say, the Encyclopedia Britannica and opening it and believing. The position should be what's in there is credible. Simply by being in Britannica, an article has credibility. And the same is not true of Wikipedia. Simply by being in Wikipedia does not have credibility, because you may hit it at the moment at which somebody has altered the John Siegenthaler article to say that he killed the Kennedys. So just being there doesn't give it credibility, but here's an important additional premise I want to put here, which is Wikipedia does have credibility. I'm not saying, I believe that Wikipedia has credibility, so my question is going to be why? What's the source of that credibility? Well, we know the source of the Britannica's credibility. It's the people and their credentials and the line of authority and expertise and professionalism, which is a genuine source of credibility. Wikipedia, of course, has none of that. It's put together by anonymous, occasionally pseudonymous strangers. Nevertheless, generally credible, especially if it's a larger article, like JFK assassination, because first of all, you know something about it, and so if there are wildly wrong things in it, you'll probably spot it. Second of all, you use the same sort of criteria that you use when you sit down next to somebody who you don't know, and you begin talking, and you make a very quick and usually correct, not always, but usually correct assessment. Is this person believable or not, based upon body language, type of words, tone of voice, does she have a sense of humor, is she willing to listen to other points of view, etc. And usually, and same thing in what we read. Not a perfect guide, but a very good guide. But there's, of course, more at Wikipedia. There's an edit page, an edit history. So we can say if a page has been heavily edited, it's more likely that the errors have been driven out. Not perfect guide, but it gives us some greater sense than come across a page that we're suspicious of and it's only had one editor. Lots of edits, more likely to be credible. And then there's the discussion page, which is this incredible artifact. We'll be able to look back at the current discussions. We want to understand the 2004 election. Well, go take a look at the Swift Boat article and at the discussion behind it. This is going to be a very important artifact. And in the discussions, we can see how it came to the conclusions that look to us to be suspicious. Now, Britannica does not show us its discussions. They consider that to be half-baked knowledge, because it's not done, as is. That's right. This is knowledge in process. But because we can't see it, we also can't evaluate the process. We can't see how they came up with ideas that may seem to us to be off base. Wikipedia, we can see it all. Wikipedia does one more thing that increases its credibility, sort of superficially, paradoxically, which is to give us warnings that an article is not credible. Don't believe this article. It needs work. In fact, there are over 100 different warnings already made, and you can make up your own if you want, which read like a catalog of all the ways an encyclopedia can go wrong. So the neutrality of this article is disputed. That's a very important one, a fairly common one. But there's also the factual accuracy has been disputed. It appears to contradict another article. It appears to contradict itself. It doesn't seem encyclopedic. It needs to cite sources. It reads like an advertisement. It reads like a sermon. It uses weasel words. And just a reminder that this is a touchy subject, please treat each other well. These warnings, these labels that tell us of Wikipedia's imperfections actually make Wikipedia more credible. And why? It's because we know we're humans. We know that we're the creatures who are fallible. I mean, this is the dividing line for millennia between us and our gods, is that we're the fallible ones. We know that. Wikipedia admits it. And by admitting it, it implicitly tells us that its main interest is in helping us come to knowledge, helping us come to truth, helping us to make a decision, a good decision. It's not all about Wikipedia. It's actually about us. And the question is why you will never see that notice here. And in part, it's because the New York Times, the Britannica, which are the examples of the great authoritative works, are more interested for various social reasons and economic reasons and reasons of pride and psychology, are more interested in being authoritative than in helping us get to truth, which is a pretty damning thing to say, but I don't know what other conclusion to come to. This is one of the reasons why traditional authority, that is to say traditional knowledge, has been so alienating in ways that we don't recognize until we have a chance on the web, through Wikipedia and through everything else we're doing there, to build knowledge ourselves, to make it our own. One more thing about Wikipedia. So you go to the tomato entry, And there's actually a subsection on how do you pronounce tomato. And most of them don't have it, but most of the articles don't have pronunciation, but because of the song, it has it. So you can then look at the discussion page for the pronunciation section of the tomato article. So I want to make up, this is just as an example, let's say there were three people who contributed to this. And the first is the world's greatest expert on tomato pronunciation, genuinely. That's what he is. In this case, it's Aristotle. We'll leave that aside. Genuinely the greatest expert, and he writes his piece and he posts it, and next day he comes back and somebody, a pseudonymous, we have no idea who, has gone through it and altered it. And this greatest expert is furious. What are you doing? I am the greatest expert on this topic. How dare you change it? All you can do is make it worse, and you have done that, sir, or madam, because we don't know. So he changes it back, and the second person comes along and changes it back again, and then a third person comes along and changes the second person's. The world's greatest expert throws up his hands and says, hats to high off. I don't have anything to do with this. Well, I'm not going to contribute to it. And so he walks off in a huff for whatever reason. Well, now the world's greatest expert can no longer participate in Wikipedia. Just can't participate, because in this case, he is incapable of engaging in a public negotiation of knowledge. The knowledge here is, in fact, so it's entirely possible that what results, the final piece that gets, that results from this, is not to the perfect liking of any of the three. They're all okay with it, but it's not what any one of them would have written. The knowledge is in the conversation. The knowledge is not in their heads. It can't be in their heads. It's not in anyone, by my example, right? I get to make it up. In this case, the knowledge in Wikipedia is exactly what's not in any one of the heads there. It's between them. So if there was ever any doubt that knowledge is not something that is contained by individuals, especially by individual experts, you just have to look at Wikipedia to realize that, well, that way of thinking is, in fact, psychotic. I would also, it seems to me, and this is highly arguable, I agree, that there is not a single case in which knowledge is not improved by being made public and being talked about. Even if it ends up being untouched because it was perfect the first time it was uttered, nevertheless, there is no case in which knowledge is not improved by being made public and negotiated. This has an effect on not just the content of knowledge, but also on who gets to decide what matters. So traditionally, the decision about what goes on the front page, what doesn't get covered at all, is made by a bunch of middle-aged white men in an airless room every day on the newspaper. Well, you know, you've been on the web for a while. If you've been on the web for a while, you realize you're not reading the news, the front page, through the newspapers anymore. For one thing, the news that you're getting in the newspaper is a day old, so you're probably skipping most of the news there and going to the really valuable stuff, which are the analysis and features. But even what constitutes a front page you're getting through email that people send you, mailing lists that you're on that say, here's something you wouldn't have found, this is a really interesting article, go take a look, through blogs, through websites that you're visiting with some regularity, and through sites like Digg, increasingly. D-I-G-G, or Reddit, R-E-D-D-I-T, Slashdot for the techies. I mean, Digg is also fairly technical, but at Digg, anybody can nominate a page as of interest, and it gets added to the queue, and readers go thumbs up, thumbs down, and that determines how high up the list, the front page, the article goes. So now it's in the hands of the readers. This will quickly, I'm sure, go social. That is, the Digg page is the cumulative thumbs up, thumbs down of all readers. They do tend to be fairly techie. That's a little undifferentiated. I'm sure that we're going to end up with things like Digg or Digg itself, where the front page is determined by not just everybody who goes there, but by social groups it forms. So I can say, you know, my friend Ethan Zuckerman, he really knows Africa. He's interested in it and knows a great deal. Show me what he's picking. And Rebecca McKinnon on North Korea, and the editors of the New York Times, put them in the mix as well. So we're creating our own front pages now. Second thing that changes is simplicity. So this is in May, President Bush gave an address. It was on a very complex topic. It was immigration. Talked from the Oval Office, and you know that his speechwriter said what all presidential speechwriters say, which is, gotta keep it simple. Big, hairy issue, keep it simple, 2,500 words, in, out, we're done. And so they did, and he gave his talk, and within a few hours, there were over 2,500 blog posts about this talk, within a few hours. It's like one per word. And you know what they did, what blog posts always do just about, which is they take something that looks simple, and they, you know, we sort of turn it upside down and see, huh, did you notice this over here? Did you notice that when he was governor, he had a different attitude towards immigration? Hey, I hear Schwarzenegger just changed his mind too. Well, how about this? You know, it contradicts the law over here. That's what bloggers do because that's what we do. That's what humans do. That's what we do when we talk. That's what conversation is. You find something that you agree about, a ground of agreement, sometimes through small talk where you sort of test the water and see, can we talk about sports? No. How about politics? No? How about movies? Almost always movies is okay. You find something that you agree on, and then you iterate on the differences. And that's what bloggers do. Well, the only reason this is at all surprising is that for 100 years we've been under a regime of broadcast where the aim has been, the economic incentive has been to reach the most people, which means coming up with the dumbest, lowest common denominator messages. And this has infected and just about ruined democracy too, by the way. But that's what we've been subject to. So we've been treated like idiots for 100 years. And we get this thing, this web, where we can connect with one another without filters and without editors and publishers. And the very first thing we want to do is connect and make the world more complex, because that's what makes the world interesting. That's where the interest is. So we are in this great revolt against simplicity, which makes me happy. And one of the reasons we can do this, we can have these messy opinions and as many as we want, is because when we're ordering stuff now, we're touching the metadata, not the stuff underneath it. So if you argue with your spouse over how to arrange your books on the shelves, only one of you can win. But if you're talking about how to organize your playlists of your electronic resources, everybody wins. You can do it as many ways as you want, because you're not touching the actual stuff. You're only touching the metadata. Metadata is liberating. The neatness of the world is baked into our old notion of taxonomy, of Aristotelian taxonomy, because feathered bipeds cuts like a knife. It says this is in and this is out. Everything that's in there is a bird. Everything that's not is not. Well, Eleanor Roche at UC Berkeley in the 70s gave pretty convincing empirical evidence that that's just not how we work. We don't think that way. In fact, the way that we work seems to be, according to her research, prototype theory, is that we learn that something is a bird by our parents pointing at it, pointing at the robin and saying, oh, birdie, see the birdie? They didn't say, oh, feathered biped, let's see what else clusters under that definition. Let's apply that rigorously. They said, birdie. And so then we got to cluster other things around it that are like it, except we got to choose which things, what the principles of likeness are. And it turns out that we don't use single principles. Feathered biped. No, we use lots of different attributes of the bird to cluster things that are like birds. This is what Wittgenstein was talking about when he famously talked about family resemblances, that there are many concepts, and his famous example is games, that simply don't have a single principle, a single definition. There is no. You take the set of games and you try to find what they have in common, they don't. And yet we're fine with the concept. It's a perfectly fine concept. And that's true of many, many, many things. We don't work by definitions. And the world seems not to work that way either. This shows up in the tagging world in the fact that we can tag something and have it be 73% in a category, 56% in another category, and 92% in another category. It doesn't even have to add up to 100. Tagging allows things to be as multiple and have as many principles of likeness as we want, as we need. And the last thing I want to talk about is context. So the internet from the beginning has been described as the information highway. It's all about information. And the counterpart to that was simultaneously it was described as and thought of as a challenge to knowledge, as a morass, a swamp of bad ideas and bad information and gossip and rumors. That both of these look at the internet as an information or knowledge phenomenon, which I think is fundamentally not what it is. We didn't rush onto the internet, a billion of us, because we wanted to become research librarians. That's not what drove us there. This is Martin Heidegger, philosopher, German philosopher, in 1927 when he wrote Being and Time. I should say, just in passing, I did my dissertation on him. I'm about to tell you something I think he said that was really true and important, but he was a Nazi prick. So in Being and Time, he asks, what does it mean to be something? This is exactly the same question that Aristotle was asking, and Aristotle answered by saying, system of similarities and differences, well-structured in a taxonomy. And Heidegger says, okay, so what does it mean to be, a hammer? Take something plebeian. A hammer. Well, to know what a hammer is in our world, and forget the Martian who comes down and what does it mean to her, him, that doesn't matter. What does it mean to us? To know what a hammer is, you have to know what a nail is and how it relates to them. And nails you don't really get unless you know about wood. And wood you don't really get unless you know about lumber yards. And lumber yards come from trees, which are in forests, which are connected to the lumber yard through an economic system. And the trees are nurtured by the sun and grow up on the earth. And you know all these things. And without that context, you couldn't know what a hammer is, and it couldn't be a hammer. That's what the meaning of a hammer is. It's this referential totality, one to another, rich, complex, implicit, inchoate, but there. And without such a totality, things simply don't have meaning. So I want to take one more step, and very soon we'll be done. It's been lots of people have pointed out that humans advance as a species, in part, by externalizing functions of consciousness. So writing externalizes memory, and books externalize knowledge, and calculators externalize arithmetic, to the dismay of elementary school teachers. This is very useful for us. This is something that we do that most other species don't. So I want to suggest that what we are now doing with the internet and everything that connects to it is not building an information resource. It is that too, of course, but that's not primarily what we're doing. What we're doing is externalizing meaning, just as we've externalized those other functions. That the internet is this collection, this miscellaneous pile of deeply connected and superficially connected pieces. And that we are now engaged in a generational process of making those connections. And we do it through tags. We don't do it in order. We may be tagging for some other, but we do it through tags. We do it through taxonomies, which are extraordinarily useful. We do it through the semantic web in some instances. We do it through every blog post and every web page, every link that's contextualized by language. Every one of those is connecting two different things in rich human ways. We do it through playlists, a remarkable new artifact. We didn't have these before. We only had lists. We have playlists that you can click on them and get to the stuff. We're doing them by the hundreds of millions. We're doing them for music and for books, and we're doing it for everything we can think of. And every one of them draws connections among pieces. And sometimes we don't care about the connections because it's just music I like. But sometimes we find deep solace in them. We find meaning in them. And that meaning is there, available as a potential. We're doing it through every way that we organize front pages for ourselves, inform one another, tell each other what matters to us. We've taken mattering into our own hands. We do it through every hyperlink. Every hyperlink is new meaning. There is potential that we created as humans in language. It's nothing more profound that we're doing. And in doing this, knowledge continues. Oh, we know how to know. We're great at it. I'm not worried about knowledge. Knowledge continues. We're going to continue building it. But it's contextualized. It exists now in a web of meaning that turns knowledge into understanding, which is what we want knowledge for in the first place. This meaning, and thus the knowledge that arises from it, now is ours. It's profoundly ours. It's not coming to us from or through an authority which we needed when we only had paper to mediate it. Now we don't need that. Now we get to make knowledge and meaning ours. Thanks. Questions? Do we have time?
Yes, we have time for questions.